Okay, I was struggling to find out what to talk about, and thankfully, I got an email from somebody on my Facebook page. And they said, I've heard about no self, and I don't understand it. What does Buddhism mean about no self? So let me talk a little bit about that today, if anybody else is confused about it or thinks they exist in a certain way. So back in the 1980s, I think it was the early 80s, I found a book by Ken Wilber called Up from Eden. And Up from Eden was talking about the evolution of human consciousness and how we went from sort of a half-asleep creature, human, animal, to a more awake creature and becoming more human. And that was because of the sense of self. So I found it fascinating that we started without the sense of self as a human, and then we finally acquired it. Never could figure out when or why, but somehow that was a blessing and a gift and a curse all at the same time. So back in the 80s, it was very popular to call it no self, that they would sometimes the authors would say there is no self. And I struggled with that because I realized that I had one. It was a rather large one. It was rather loud at times. And how could they tell me that that didn't exist because that was how I made a living and that was how I interacted with other human beings and that's how I was recognized as being similar to the people I had been before a day ago, a week ago, a month ago, a year ago. So there seemed to be some consistency between this thing called myself and a self. And so again, I struggled. And then later on, I started reading books about the self. And for some reason, the authors in the books changed it from no self to not self. And I'm going, okay, now I can work with not self. I can say and think and feel that I have a self, but it really doesn't define me in an ultimate way. It's a relative understanding. A relative feeling of being in community with other human beings who also have the illusion of self as well. And that's how we communicate and understand each other by having that definition of who we are. So, how do we get that? How do we define ourselves? What do we do? What has happened to us? Why is this thing so strong and so defensible that if somebody intimidates us or curses us or tries to make us feel bad, we feel that we have to defend ourselves and arguments happen and anger happens and all the stuff that happens when you have something to defend. So I look back on my life and I'm thinking to myself, you know, it's all my parents' fault because they're the ones that's kept talking to me. You know, you're going to be somebody one day, but right now you're nobody, and we're going to send you to school to make you into somebody. So I'm going to grade school, I'm going to kindergarten, I'm going to high school, and I'm doing all the things that necessary for me to become somebody. And I love Ram Dass because Ram Dass talks about in the beginning of our life, we're in somebody training, and towards the end of our life, we're in nobody training. We're training to be nobody after a certain age. And again, I was a bit confused by that, but now that I'm old, I realized, yeah, that's exactly right. The idea of getting old and becoming nobody is so we can rest in peace as they take us to our cemetery plot with a wonderful marker saying, yes, he lived, and yes, he died, and yes, he was somebody, and now he's nobody. And there we are until the end of the world or the end of the cemetery or somebody steals our marker or whatever it is. But up until that point, we might have had 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years of being somebody, of thinking we existed in a certain way. So I think if we look at the teachings of the Buddha, what we start to understand is he only taught two things. And in the hundreds or thousands of talks that he gave, those two things are why we suffer as a human being, and how to end that suffering as a human being. And one of the major reasons of our suffering is that we think we exist in a certain identifiable way, that is who we are. And we find ourselves in all these situations, and we have to be resourceful and flexible in dealing with the circumstances and the people in the circumstances. And that's what self does. Self can be a real good friend, you know, but it can also turn out to be the master, you know, and anybody who's ever had a master or someone who's been in charge of their life for a while, like parents, realize that good feeling and the bad feeling are always subject to change. That depending on how they're feeling today and depending on how you're feeling today, that's going to define you for 12 hours, 24 hours, 48 hours, however long, until it changes. And of course, it always does change. So if we get back to the idea of self, we are not the self, but there very well could be a self. Now, I was reading an article on self, and they did a poll. And they said, how many people think they have a soul, and how many people think they have a self? And more people thought they had a soul than the people that thought they had a self. So if you extend the Buddha's idea of not self, we can also include not soul. Now, for me, in the beginning, it was like, you know, I've never felt like I had a soul, though I was baptized as a child. So if I died as a child and never became somebody, I would go to heaven because my soul was baptized and I was blessed. And it made my parents feel really comfortable and good about that. Okay, me being, what, 2, 3, 4 months, I had no idea I was even living, let alone had to die. So as I look back on that, I'm going, yeah, you know, coming from a Christian background and living in a Christian country, so to speak, soul becomes really important. The people of the book, Jews, Christians, Muslims, people of the book, they have souls. And those souls will forever exist in some way, at some level. And for Buddhists to say, well, you know, there may be a soul there. I don't know. But that's not who I am either. And there may be a self there. I don't really know, but I feel like it. I've been given evidence that a self exists, but I don't really know. And is it okay not to be the self? Is it okay not to be the soul? And actually, I think we don't have much of a choice. You know, self keeps arising whether we want it to or not. We can modify it. We can train it. We can school it. We can hold back some of the tendencies of the self to get into trouble. If one is prone to gambling, well, we can, you know, join a group and learn why gambling might not be as skillful as it turns out to be, even though it's a whole lot of fun. or drinking or taking drugs or all the things we do because our self wants to be satisfied in one way or the other. It wants to be happy. It doesn't want to be sad. It wants to venture into altered states of consciousness. You know, there's talking in Los Angeles here about making psychedelics legal so we can all trip out all the time and just have a wonderful life. Or we can do the marijuana thing, you know, and that's going on too. And we can encourage people to get vaccinated as well. That's the self speaking there. So what is this thing? Why does it drive us in a certain way? Well, we always seem to be driven towards happiness and away from sadness, or pleasure and away from pain. And the self is really good at that. The self figures out what the pain is. The self figures out that, yeah, if there's enough pain, you will die. So the idea is to avoid the pain or get away from the pain. And then the self comes up with an idea of how to do that. And we go, okay, cool. You know, so if I have an old car with no air conditioning, self says, maybe you could get a new car with air conditioning and you'd be so much happier and so much cooler, and wouldn't life be wonderful then? And we keep listening to these little voices in our heads saying, yeah, I bet I could do that. You know, maybe I could lease for $100 a month and have an air-conditioned car and life would be so good until the first accident or the first ding or somebody steals it or somebody takes your catalytic converter or on and on and on. Yeah, okay, cool. But that's the self. It's really good at making stuff up, writing the story, and having a good ending. The self always wants to have an ending that's better than suffering, and it goes about doing it. Now, sometimes the self's not very skillful, and sometimes it's really skillful. Sometimes the self is not apparent, and sometimes it's right in our face. When we look at the consequences of what happened, we go, wow, how could I have done that? And the key to that is the I. How could I have done that? How could self had done that? Well, self isn't known as being the wisest phenomena in the world. Self is sometimes pretty stupid because it's dealing with greed, hatred, and delusion, which filters through it all the time. And it's difficult to get beyond that. Okay, so now we got the self. We've been to school. We've got a job. We might be in a relationship. And self is really strong and really good. So how could you say that doesn't exist? And the idea, I think, is to say, well, let's see how I feel if I don't have to be the self all the time. And what's a good way to not be self? Well, meditation is one avenue that we can sit down and quietly wait for self to settle. Sort of like rocks in water or mud in water. And if we put the muddy water on the table, given enough time, the mud settles to the bottom and the water becomes clearer. And given enough time in our meditation practice, as the self starts to settle, a new kind of awareness, a new kind of clarity starts to be available to us that we didn't have before, because it's not being filtered through the self quite as much. Okay, and we can have insights, and we can see things differently, and we can have a different kind of knowing as opposed to understanding. So I like to define relative intellectual understanding as being one way, and ultimate non-dual knowing being another way. That's how I do it in my mind. I'm going, okay, so we have a knowing and we have an understanding, and one is intellectual and one is intuitive. And in meditation practice, it seems to exercise my intuition and allow the intellect to relax for a while and not have to decipher and decode and understand. I can simply feel and have a knowing of the situation that's not necessarily definable or even understandable, but it does allow me to experience my life and the world in a different way. Okay, so did the Buddha ever say we are only one thing? No, the Buddha never went there. He never went to the one. You know, and one is such an important concept. It's such a big number. Because if you have one, it generally includes everything. And then we get to two, and now we have dualism. And then we get to three, and now we have a multiplicity that's much more difficult to understand. And so by saying you're one thing, you're really oversimplifying the concept of existence. And I say that because as you venture through Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist wisdom, you come to understand that rather than existing independently and being one thing, we exist in an interconnected and an interdependent way, that everything supports us. We cannot exist by being one. We need to be connected to the many for our existence. So here we are, and now we've settled our mind, and we're starting to feel that interconnection, that interdependence, and there's something else there. Now, in Mahayana Buddhism, they call it Buddha nature. That I define Buddha nature as having the potential to realize enlightenment at any time. That we don't have to necessarily go here and do this and be that. Some have said we're already enlightened. We just need to realize that fact. We need to wake up to that fact. We need to not understand it, but to know it. Okay, cool. So what did the Buddha say we were? Well, number one, he said we are name and form. Okay, we're not only name, we're not only form, we're both. He said we have the five aggregates, the five heaps, as some have called it. Form, sensation, perception, volition, and consciousness. And they're always interacting with each other, and they're always subject to impermanence and change, and that's why they don't exist in an independent, unchanging way. Does anything exist in an independent, unchanging way? The Buddha would say no. The only thing that's beyond all of the change and suffering is nirvana. Okay, so we have that one reference point, nirvana, that allows us to know there's an answer. Remember the Buddha said, I teach you why you suffer and I teach you how to end your suffering. And you're not going to find the end of suffering in any of the five aggregates. In name and form, it doesn't exist. That is exactly the reason you are suffering. Because you think those things are you. So in our meditation practice, we start to have all that stuff sort of settle. And then the big question comes, well, who am I? What defines me now? What defines me today? What defines me this year? What defines me in my old age, my middle age, my youth or young age? What was the defining characteristics? Well, those characteristics are always in play. They're always in flux. We can't ever go back to be who we used to be. Though sometimes, you know, there's this sort of romantic idealism of finding the fountain of youth so you never have to get old. But I tell you, if you think about it in any kind of logical, realistic way, it would be nice to have a younger body, but I wouldn't want to have the young mind trying to deal with the complexity of the world. It's a no-win situation. We gain a little knowledge, we think we got it, and then something else comes up and says, no, that's not it. And then something else comes up and says, no, you missed it, man. You know, go back to the drawing board. You're almost there, but not quite. And so the thing about old age, you know, I'm finding is that there's a certain healthy I don't know that happens. And that don't know can also happen in our meditation practice. Sometimes when we think we know, it gives us the wrong information. So can we be in a place that we don't know and still survive and still be clever and still be skillful? And I would say yes, because it doesn't depend on any one thing. It depends on a variety of things to be skillful and wholesome and good and intelligent and intuitive. There's all sorts of stuff going on. So we have the five aggregates. We have name and form. We say to ourselves, I don't know who I am, but I still exist. I still have lunch. I still take a nap. I still feed cats. All those things happen, and I'm not sure why. But it doesn't matter because they're still happening. And that's a good thing. And you can get in your car and turn the key. And do you have to remember how to drive in order to drive? I've come to the conclusion that some people should go over the rules every time they go into their car. But generally speaking, most of us are working at this sort of intuitive level of, I know what I'm doing. I don't have to define it and understand it because I've done it for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years or however long you've been driving. And it still works. There's a certain flow. There's a certain intuition in good driving. There's a certain understanding of the rules of the road and realizing not everybody knows those. So there's a defensive attitude as well as you hit the freeways and byways of California that my job is to get from point A to point B. And along the way, I might have some wonderful experiences and I might have some really negative experiences, but that's just part of the flow and doesn't have to define me and doesn't have to make me one way or the other. So I wish we could share that with all the road rage people out there who just go bananas and ballistic when somebody cuts them off or goes in front of them. My gosh, you know? It's just another way to respond to the world. Okay, let's avoid that. Let's avoid this. And the self still works, even though we don't have to be the self all the time. Now, let me, words of warning. If you're driving and somebody in the highway patrol pulls you over and they're not Broderick Crawford, and they say, I need to see your registration and driver's license, sir. And we show them our registration and driver's license. And then because you've been meditating for 30 or 40 years, and you've come to the concept of not self and you've embraced it totally, you could say to the officer, you know, sir, this really isn't who I am. I'm a complex bunch of things that are always changing and in process. Okay, well, the officer needs you to be the guy or gal in the driver's license. The officer needs you to be the owner of the car, or at least registered to you. And he doesn't care. And most of your close friends aren't going to care whether you think you're who you are or not, as long as they know who you are. And you never want to tell your parents that you're not who they think you are, because they brought you into the world and they made you into somebody. And so they want to be comfortable with the idea that you have not gone insane and that you are who they think you are. Okay, cool. So can we do that? Can we do all those things and not be self? Yes, we can. And when you're not self, there's less to defend. There's less to define. There doesn't seem to be less to do. In fact, there seems to be more to do because now everything becomes available to you. It's an amazing paradox to go and say, I'm not self, and the world opens up because you're not restricted. You're not confined into being a certain person in a certain way. You are now the universe and interacting with it in a variety of ways. So you have so much more potential when you're not self than when you are self. Self becomes a little prison all its own. And the door, the key is locked until you come into the realm of Buddhism and the practice of meditation. And therefore you will see a key. And your job is to pick up the key, put it in the lock, and open that door. And that door leads you to freedom. And freedom from what? The wise people say. Freedom from suffering. When you don't have a self to suffer, your suffering ends. But as soon as you cling to the idea of who you are or what you are, you have the potential to suffer again and again and again. Now, do people with no self feel pain? Absolutely. Pain is not optional. But the thing about the self is the self says, I feel pain, I'll be dead soon, I got to do something about it. Sometimes it's just transitory. It's just a momentary pain and it goes away, like a knee or a shoulder. And so we don't really need to do gymnastics to deal with the pain. We can come to a place of acceptance with it, understanding that we have a mind and a body, and we're subject to pain until that last moment, and then finally we no longer will feel pain. I remember listening to an interview by William Shatner, Star Trek guy. When I was in high school, I used to watch it, Star Trek. So I got to see it first run. And William Shatner has tinnitus or tinnitus, however one wants to pronounce it. He's got the ringing in the ear. And sometimes it just drives him crazy. He can't stand it. And so he went to the doctor. And the doctor said to him, well, William, Bill, a few moments before you die, you'll get rid of your tinnitus, your tinnitus, and you'll never have to hear it again. And he says, Doc, I got to wait till I'm almost dead to get rid of it. Something to look forward to, those few moments before you pass into the altered reality of death. So there you go. So we have to come to a place of acceptance. Bill's accepting his tinnitus and working with it. And, you know, a lot of people have it and work with it. And a lot of people have bad knees and bad legs and they work with it. And it's easier to come to a place of acceptance with it rather than saying, it's my bad leg. Why me? Why am I the victim of this bad leg? Why am I the victim of ringing in the ear? Why did it have to happen to me? And we get to that place where there is no I, me, or mine, relatively speaking. And some people have said, but we use that as those terms all the time, I, me, and mine. So how can you get rid of that? Well, you can't. You can't get rid of those words because that's how we communicate and relate to each other through writing and speaking. And they serve a function, but they don't necessarily identify the truth of who we are. We are simply an I, me, and mine. And that's a relative understanding used in the context of language. And that's fine. All languages have that, as far as I know. And that's how we define self from other. You know, this is mine, and that's yours, and no, you can't have mine. That works fine. That's how the words work. So we don't need to get confused by the words. We simply need to understand that the Buddha gave us a real insight. He said, you know what? There may be a self, but that's not who you are.